es para ti.
Welcome back to the Library Cafe, a weekly program of table talk with scholars and librarians about books, ideas, and the formation and circulation of knowledge. I'm Thomas Hill. Today we are continuing our conversation with Elizabeth Parravicini-Ghibert, Professor of Caribbean Literature and Culture at Vassar College, about the book of which she is co-author with Marguerite Fernandez-Olmos, entitled Creole Religions of the Caribbean, An Introduction from Voodoo and Santeria to Obe and Espiritismo, published by New York University Press. Welcome back, Lisa.
Well, thank you for having me back.
Last week we talked mainly about what these belief systems have in common and about the practices that developed on the island of Cuba in particular, including Santeria and the Regla de Palo. And that discussion, by the way, for our listeners who weren't able to hear it, is available on our website at library-cafe.org. And just to adjust our focus a bit and expand on something we touched on last week, you talked last week about the sculptured head of Alegua that you reproduce in your book appearing frightful only to someone who's an outsider to Caribbean Creole religions, and that to a practitioner of Santeria or someone who has grown up in a Caribbean culture, the image of this disembodied head in a bowl with shells for eyes and a mouth doesn't appear frightening but actually comforting. And when you think about it, someone seeing a Christian crucifix for the first time, say, hanging over a bed in a Catholic hospital, might have the same reaction toward what on the face of it is a fairly grisly image, however you look at it, although people accustomed to Christian culture view this also as an image of comfort. So my point, I suppose, is that it's good to keep in mind when looking at the religious and cultural practices of others that what might seem disturbing or gruesome or just plain strange to an outsider looking in may well seem comforting and perhaps also perfectly ordinary to someone who has grown up with these practices. And I think this is one thing your book seems to try to do, mediate this otherness rather than use it to sensationalize your subjects.
Yes, we were exactly trying to do that, to present these religions and these practices as things that are natural to the environment in which they developed and where they are practiced. As you said of the head of Alegua, it is comforting. It is a sign that someone believes in Alegua, that he protects the threshold to the household, that you are entering a space where people have sought to have some communion with the spirits who live their lives spiritually and so forth. So the objects themselves may be frightening, but the elements that make up that figure, for example, the cement, which everybody's familiar with because people so often work on constructing their houses themselves, the shells for eyes that they pick on the beach and so forth. These are all elements that are around them, and they also have a part in creating the heads, in creating the spaces where the spirits will live. So, you know, it depends on what perspective you look at things from.
Yeah. So, on to Haiti. If some people listening may never have heard, say, of Obi or Santeria, everyone, I think, has heard of voodoo, or at least the Hollywood version. And certainly voodoo is something that our culture seems to love to sensationalize. But voodoo isn't primarily about zombies or dolls with pins in them, is it?
No, it's not at all, which is one of the reasons why this book was written, to make sure that people have access to an introduction that is free of jargon, that is written in a way that both scholars and the average reader can have access to, but that presents these religions in the way that they work in the societies where they are practiced, that where there are naturally occurring phenomena that is not the stuff of nightmarish tales. I think that the whole focus on zombies is something that came from a very specific historical moment, which was the occupation of Haiti by U.S. Marines from 1915 to 1934. Mm. The language barrier led to a lot of misunderstandings about what these religions meant. And many, quite a few of these Marines returned to the United States to write books mm-hmm. about Haiti, things like Black Baghdad, and things that sort of created an idea in the American public that these religions were associated with evil, sorcery, spells, all kinds of demonic connections. And also they focused on this notion of the zombie at a time when Hollywood was creating their first horror films.
Yeah.
So we'll forever associate zombification and zombies with Bela Lugosi.
Yeah.
And that was a film that came out during the occupation.
Can you talk about the unusual history of Haiti in the wider Caribbean context and how voodoo and its various liturgies came to be developed?
Well, one of the things to remember about Haitian history is that during the 18th century, Haiti was the crowning colony of France. It was actually the most productive, the richest colony in the entire world at the time. And that wealth that was generated by Haiti was dependent on bringing to Haiti thousands upon thousands of slaves from various parts of Africa that essentially had about a 2 to 3 year lifespan once they arrived in Haiti. But the influx of slaves...
The slaves had a two to three year lifespan
because the conditions were brutal. Mm. The violence associated with maintaining a slave system in a colony where about 97% of the population was enslaved, and the other 3% had to hold them under some sort of control, led to a violence that is unimaginable. But it was in this kind of crucible of contact that voodoo practices really gathered the quality that makes voodoo today. It was in the syncretism, in the creolization, the bringing together of a multiplicity of practices from Africa that were similar, but each group brought different elements, that voodoo took shape. As early as the beginning of the Haitian Revolution, you know, the first intimations of revolution came in the 1750s, where a leader called Makandal, an Ungan trained in the practices of West African religions, what was to become Vodun, actually put together a plan to poison the planters in the northern part of Haiti. And this effort was only possible because as an Ungan, as an herbalist, as a practitioner of voodoo, he had knowledge, intimate knowledge of the secrets of the forest. But all these different elements that would crystallize into voodoo were aided in many ways by the fact that in the 19th century, the Catholic Church was essentially expelled from Haiti. So there were long periods of time where there was, you know, limited priestly presence, where Catholicism developed into very local practices.
And this was after the revolution.
This was after the revolution. So by the time in the late 19th century, when the church was invited back to reassert its power over the souls of the people, as Trollope would write, the souls of the people had a double allegiance. But that period of absence of, let's call it Catholic guidance, provided a space in which the practices that we have today and we know as voodoo crystallized and explains in part why, you know, people talk about Haiti as 97% Catholic but 100% voodoo. Many Haitians practice both Catholicism and voodoo without seeing a contradiction between the continuity of the practices.
Yeah. But there are Protestant now. There is a Protestant missionary activity going on the island that isn't so accommodating.
Yes, this is a new development in Haiti. It's an interesting one because Catholicism and voodoo flourish side by side. And Catholicism has been very sort of Catholic in allowing people not asking too many questions and understanding that there are functions that voodoo has played, particularly in healing functions in places where there is little access to medical practitioners of the Western sort. Mm. And although there have been very violent, what they call anti-superstitious campaigns in Haiti, during many of which Ungans and other practitioners were jailed, killed, and so forth, the fact is that there was a kind of continuity of practices where each side allowed the other one to play its role because they were sort of complementary. Yeah. You know, for example, if you think of Aristide, former president of Haiti, when he was a priest, one of the reasons he got sort of defrocked by the Pope was that he would wear vestments in mass that had images of the Luas, the spirits of voodoo, embroidered into them. So sometimes the veves, these mythical figures that are danced over, that are sort of painted on the floor of the unforts in cornmeal before the ceremonies begin, and then are kind of destroyed, if that's the right word, by the dancers. He had some of those veves in his vestments, signaling an acceptance of the relationship between the two religions. Protestantism is very different. Protestantism has come into Haiti threatening in many ways the very nature of voodoo practices, because Protestant missionaries who are very welcome in Haiti because they bring, you know, access to education, medical care, all sorts of aid from the United States.
And Haiti is very poor.
And Haiti is very poor, so all this work, all this help is very welcome, particularly when it comes to educating children and vaccinations and so forth. Protestant missionaries threaten voodoo in serious ways because when a person is converted, is kind of born again into Christianity, they require proof that the person has given up the non-Christian practices of voodoo. So one of the things that they require is a formal and public renunciation of voodoo, meaning that all their artifacts, you know, flags and dolls and paintings, everything that they have used in their home altars, anything that is associated with voodoo practices has to be brought in to publicly be burned before before the person is baptized.
That's not very syncretic of them, is it?
Well, it's not very syncretic. It also is very worrisome to many intellectuals and scholars in Haiti or of Haiti, because a lot of objects that are part of the material culture of the Haitian people, sometimes objects that have been in families for generations, flags that have been made sometimes with extraordinary skill and which are very valuable in terms of the legacy of Haitian creativity that they bring with them, are being destroyed in the process. But Protestantism in Haiti has proven to be not very syncretic, not very amenable to the kind of creolization that we're talking about in this book. So it looms there as a threat to the development of the continued development of voodoo.
Interesting, talking about Protestantism and Protestant missionaries. I watched the PBS Frontline documentary on the Mormons earlier this month as I was reading your book, and it struck me while I was watching that voodoo, like Mormonism, is a religion born of dislocation and persecution and is centered on an idea of spiritually united extended families, which include ancestors that need to be ritually attended to, tied to specific geographical places and specific temples of worship located within these places. And of course, music is an important part of the liturgy of both religions, as indeed it is with so many religions. But here I think the similarities cease. For one thing, the spiritual and moral authority of women has a prominent place in Haitian voodoo, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. You know, women have been central to the development of voodoo, in part because they are allowed the same functions and positions that men can achieve within voodoo. So the presence of women, not only as heads of temples where they are most welcome, but also as the assistants that keep the temple functioning, is very important. And this sort of separates it from Mormonism, Catholicism, yeah. and so forth. The other thing is the centrality also of the female spirits. Mm-hmm. In Haitian voodoo, give women a more important role, a more equal role in their practices. And this is interesting because the Mormons are a very central presence, not only in Haiti, but throughout Latin America. When we talk about the kinds of threat that Protestantism poses for voodoo, I should also note that the Mormons are part of the force of eradication of not only voodoo, but native forms of Christianity throughout the Americas.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So with voodoo, there is no central liturgical authority, is there?
No, there is no central liturgical authority.
Or any of these religions, really.
No, there is no pope. There is no figure from which dogma emanates in these religions. No, there is a central core of beliefs that is shared throughout Haiti. But every unfort, every community works within this framework in different ways. You know, we talked when we were talking about Santeria about various avatars, about various forms that the spirits will take. And in Haitian voodoo particularly, these avatars may change from community to community. So you may have one spirit, such as Erzuli, the goddess of love, but the avatars, the manifestations of Erzuli will vary from community to community, depending on the nature of the community. Mm-hmm. The interesting thing is that there is a shared body of knowledge that is not necessarily written, like it is in the Cuban libretas, in the Cuban notebooks that for santeros century, use. Yeah. But now, of course, there are scholars writing down all kinds of things. Mm-hmm. So it's not that there is not a written record. But the communities themselves do not work from a written record. They work from an oral transmission, and people who come into the community will bring from, if they're coming from the rural area, they'll bring different manifestations of the spirits, and they will also join in. Yeah. But it's a dynamic place, not a religion where
there's a doctrine.
Is kind of determined from above and is put into practice below. Yeah. But it's actually a kind of very dynamic enterprise where, you know, new laws, new spirits that are venerated may spring up in a particular place, and those spirits will have no presence in another place.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that, because you mentioned in the book that many of the spirits, or the tutelary figures in the African religions as they're transported to the Caribbean, are lost, so the pantheon of Santeria and voodoo are much smaller. And you mentioned especially the agricultural figures get lost, because it's not in the interest of slaves to
foster agriculture for their masters.
But after the Haitian Revolution, when ex-slaves then become subsistence farmers and agriculture becomes important to them, do they recall any of their earlier agricultural laws?
Yeah, it's interesting because in Haitian voodoo, there is a distinction made between the gods who came from Africa, and those are actually the most venerated because they are seen as having accompanied their people across the Middle Passage. And this is really very important in Afro-Caribbean religions, but particularly in Haiti. The whole idea of the piece of land, the family land, which is called the family's héritage, or the family's heirloom, so to speak, because the family spirits reside within that land. So this is why losing the land in Haiti is such a devastating thing for a family. As long as there's some member of the family that remains on the family's land, then there is a connection. But if that land is lost, then it's also a severing of the ties to the lois, or to the spirits. So when the slaves had to abandon Africa, the idea of abandoning their spirits behind, because the spirits are attached to the land, was a very serious matter. So the spirits that came with them. Essentially, you can say, well, they brought them.
Over the Middle Passage.
Middle Passage. Yeah. But they are seen not as having been brought, but as the spirits actually willingly having left their land to come and accompany them to the Middle Passage. And That is very interesting. You can see it in art, for example, sometimes in representations of the Luas accompanying the boat people, Haitian boat people on their crossing from Haiti to Miami. Mm-hmm. And in the paintings of boat people, you will see sometimes there is a beautiful painting by, I never know if it's Duval Carrier or Carrier Duval. It's Duval Carrier, the Haitian painting. Mm-hmm. There's a beautiful painting at the Bass Museum in Miami that shows Erzuli, the goddess of love, very coquettish, very beautiful, light-skinned mulatta, actually descending in tears from a Coast Guard ship.
Oh.
But it's a reference to this idea of the spirits accompanying their people. And it's good of the spirits, it's big of their spirits to leave their land to come with them. So in Haiti, you have those spirits that came across.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, there are all those lost spirits that did not make the crossing that remain behind. And those are the Luas, the spirits of the Rara rites. But there's also the Petwa rites in Haiti, and those are the spirits that were born of the plantation and the sufferings of the plantation, and those are the spirits that are generated in Haiti. So,
and these could have been real people at one time.
And those could have been real people. For example, Dessalines, one of the leaders of the Haitian Revolution, considered to have been the most violent and brutal in his destruction of the plantation economy and the planters class, he has emerged in certain areas of Haiti as a Lua. There is a U.S. Marine that, for reasons that I still cannot fathom, has actually emerged as a Lua in areas of Haiti.
He had an overpowering personality.
So there is that idea of developing Luas out of the process of acculturation into Haiti. So you had two types of Lua, the Rada who came across and the Petwa who were born in Haiti. So there, when you look at those, you can see the development in Haiti of avatars, later avatars of agricultural spirits that seem to have been quote-unquote, left behind, meaning they served no purpose when they got to Haiti. The slaves were not going to call upon spirits that aided agriculture in the service of the masters. But then when, after the revolution, when land is distributed and the former slaves become planters, small farmers themselves, then figures like Loco and Ayizang, this is a couple, male and female, who are the first herbalists, and actually the figures that went to gather the leaves and other things you needed for healing from the forest. And they have Haitian avatars that surface again after the revolution, together with the figure of Cousin Zaka, which is now the figure of the Lua who gathers crops. And it is interesting that when he emerges as a Lua, he emerges not as a powerful spirit that comes from the heavens to rain prosperity, but he emerges as a farmer himself, as a peasant with a sack, you know, for gathering the crops from his little heritage, from his little farm. So he emerges as a, you know, as a small planter, as a subsistence planter, as a spirit. So you can see, you know, how these figures that existed in, you know, these are spirits that who did not come across, but who developed avatars in Haiti that serve the new purposes of aiding agricultural production at a very low scale.
Oh, interesting. You talk in the book about voodoo being a religion of service, and I wonder if you can elaborate on that.
Yes, what that refers to is really the reciprocity of the relationship between the spirits and the believers. The believers are called, interestingly enough, servers, serviteurs. So you don't believe in the spirits, you don't worship the spirits, you serve the spirits. So the verb actually used for practicing the religion is serving the spirits. So the whole idea is one of reciprocity. And the way the reciprocity works is that you want the spirits to help you, either by aiding you in problems you have, helping with the fertility of the land, whatever it is, healing a family member who is sick. Mm-hmm. And the way that you communicate with the spirits is by providing them what the spirits themselves need and cannot get. Sustenance, for example. You know, so you have altars where you will provide, you know, little portions of the favorite foods of your tutelary spirit. People will often, if they are very serious in their service to the spirits, they will not eat or drink anything before first offering a little bit to the spirit. And you will see people pouring a few drops of rum on the floor before they drink from their glass. And it's because the spirits live beneath the waters. They live underground, so that you put some on the earth and that sustains the spirits. But it's an act of recognition of service. Mm-hmm. So the service to the Luas is the way you practice your religion. Mm-hmm. And in return, the spirits will communicate with you. For example, when you look at things like the centerpiece of Vodun practice, which is possession. Uh-huh. I mean, here is one where Hollywood has taken off. Yeah. In terms of what it means to be possessed, no? But what possession is in Haitian Vodun is a form of very generous, very unselfish kind of service. Because what happens in possession, if you were in a ceremony, ceremonies are held sometimes for healing purposes, for helping people with problems, illnesses, ecological devastation, poverty. So when you have a service and the drums are playing, the drums will be calling for particular lua to come down and speak to the people. So if you are possessed, if you are the one that in the course of this drumming are placed in a situation where you were ready for possession, that is, for example, one of the most intense forms of service, mm-hmm. not only to the spirit, but to the community. It's reciprocal, mm-hmm. because the person that is mounted or the person that is possessed doesn't benefit from the possession at all, mm-hmm. but serves the spirit, mm-hmm. because it gives a body to the spirit to speak. What the spirit doesn't have is mm-hmm. a voice. And Vodun is known as the voice of the gods. Uh-huh. You know, the practice is that of giving voice to the gods. So, and then that spirit will speak through you or through the person possessed mm-hmm. to the community to answer their questions. Nice. You know, just it gives you an idea of what service means, uh-huh. you know, and possession is part of that basic notion of being servers, servitors to the spirits.
Yeah. And movement also. You write that voodoo is first and foremost a dance, and quoting Joseph Murphy, a system of movements which brings people and Iwa together in a progressive mutual relationship of knowledge and growth.
Yes, well, because this is exactly what happens during possession, that how do you get to the moment in a ceremony where that moment of possession can happen? It happens through music and dance. Mm-hmm. What creates the environment necessary for possession to take place is dance. Mm-hmm. So sort of think about a ceremony which is all about dancing, mm-hmm. from the moment that the flags are danced in.
Yeah. You know, I'm sure these cornmeal.
Well, you have those on the ground. So, in preparation for a ceremony, you will have the veves, the mm-hmm. cornmeal drawings on the floor. Usually, the ones that relate to this particular mm-hmm. luas that you want to appeal to, because are the ones that rule over mm-hmm. certain aspects of life. So, if it's a ceremony that has to do with love or mm-hmm. or what the tutelary spirit of the person that needs healing is, those veves will be drawn on the mm-hmm. floor.
And the paintings, too, that show these ceremonies, I'm always struck at how aesthetically beautiful they are.
Yes. And you've seen the beautiful sequined flags. So you have these flags in a Unford, a temple, may have a multiplicity of flags. Mm-hmm. But if you're looking for a particular lua or luas to come in, you may pick those flags mm-hmm. to open the ceremony and have the veves and, you know, drawn with cornmeal on the floor. And the drummers who have been trained, being a drummer in Haitian Vodou, it's a process that entails a lot of training, not only in drumming, but also in knowing what the particular drumming of particular luas is. And people have to be initiated. These drums, the sacred drums, will only play at certain times during the day. And they are blessed. The drums themselves go through a process of blessing and dedication to the spirit. So once you have that kind of energy, knowledge, and training devoted to just getting the music right, you can see how important the music is. So the drums will play calling for a particular lua, and each lua has its particular songs that they will play and sing and dance their particular dances. So the normal ceremony actually starts with the flags being danced into the room. And people will walk in with the flags on poles, dancing them through the Unfort. And then the congregation, the, if you can call it the congregation, the community, will join in and dance and dance and dance and dance. Every song has its meaning. Every dance has its meaning. But the cumulative impact of this music and dance is the ceremony itself, is the worship. Music and dance, which sometimes appears incidental to ritual in, let's say, Catholicism. So the ritual is the ritual and can be done without music. And at some point in particular, if in a particular church or if it's a particular ceremony, a wedding or solemn mass or a funeral, then music will come in. Well, imagine that the ritual is the music and the dancing. There is no other ritual. There is no moment where the priest gives his, it's a sermon. The ritual is the dancing. And that music and dancing should, at some point, actually coax the spirits to come in. They come in through the center post. The Potomitan is a center post of the temple. They come in from lava, from underneath. They come in and then they have to manifest themselves somehow. They have to be able to speak to the community. And in order to speak, somebody has to serve them. Somebody has to relinquish control of their body for the period that the god needs it to communicate. But the ritual is the dance.
So before we move off the Isle of Haiti, I wonder if you could talk just a bit about zombies, since I know you've studied them.
Yeah, the poor zombies. I feel so bad when they're running through malls and being killed. because it's such a travesty, the poor things.
Yeah,
Dawn of the Dead and so forth. Yes, zombies are peripheral to Vodun in the sense that zombification, the whole process of zombification, is not something that an Ungan will do. The Ungan or priest or leader of a particular religious community is someone who will always work with the right hand, meaning that they will use their skills, knowledge of herbs, you know, knowledge of curative practices and so forth, always for the good. But you have secret societies called Bizango, very akin to the Abakwa societies in Haiti, mostly male, sort of like Masons. And there, the Ungans that are members of secret societies actually change their names to Bokors, just to separate them from the ones that only work with the right hand. So a Bokor may work with the right hand or with the left hand, meaning that sometimes they will use their knowledge and their command of herbs and other practices to do things that from a particular point of view may be negative. Now, that doesn't mean that they're sorcerers to whom you go to do evil to other people.
There isn't really a concept of good and evil in voodoo or these religions the way we think of it, is there?
It's not the same as Catholicism where everything is kind of good or, or evil. But there are things that may be considered harmful to a person, but that are required for community justice, for example. So these Bizango societies work as a kind of court of appeal, particularly in places where the legal system has broken down or in situations where there is a right and there is a wrong. And the law actually protects the wrong. You know, the law may allow things that the community feels are injustices to happen. It may happen, for example, with a common law couple who has a number of children but no marriage. There's an héritage, there's a plot of land that belongs to the family. Without access to that land, the family may starve. But at the death of the father, the land does not go to his heirs. Or there are other heirs that have maybe a legal wife that has a claim to this. And these are situations where the law will protect what the community feels is an injustice. And Bisango societies may work to redress some of the situations. They have power. They have the power of instilling fear in the community. They may be very persuasive in brokering some sort of compromise that comes closer to what we know as justice. And within this system, zombification is a form of capital punishment, may we say? Because what it is the cases of zombification, the documented cases, are very rare, are very small. The practice is very, very rare and was actually first studied in detail by Zora Neale Hurston, the American writer and anthropologist. So she was the one that actually first wrote about zombification as being something that involved a potion, administering a potion, that it was not a kind of magical sorcery thing, but it was actually connected with a certain kind of drug. And what happens during zombification, there's a potion. You may get the recipe from Wade Davis's Passage of Darkness. It was his doctoral dissertation at Harvard, and he actually discovered, obtained, bought. We don't know how he got it. He got it from a bookstore. And he went there to look at the possibilities of using this in lieu of anesthesia in Western practices. So this was a pharmacological, sort of anthropological, pharmacological research, an ethnobotany project. So what happens during zombification is that a potion is administered and it paralyzes. It's very akin to what we know as the effects of curare, which in Hollywood movies is what Brazilian Indians, natives will put on arrows, and that will paralyze you and paralyzes the nervous system. But you remain aware, although incapable of movement, you are still very much aware of what is happening right around you, but totally powerless to move. And sometimes you may be buried. You may go through the process of a funeral. There's very little embalming in Haiti, and usually this is true of all the Caribbean, except in the modern urban centers where there's, you know, refrigeration and so forth. But usually in the Caribbean, at least in the small village where I grew up, for example, people would be buried, if they died in the morning, would be buried in the afternoon. There is an urgency about matters of burial in the tropics that I don't want to go into.
I don't want to get gruesome. Understandable, here. In any hot climate, actually.
So that the person is then unburied and given an antidote to the potion. So that's the physical process of zombification, which can be very traumatic and psychologically crippling. But where religion comes in has to do with the beliefs about the nature of the soul in Haitian Vodun, and the idea that your soul has two components, the petit bonange and the gros bonange. So the process of zombification entails the vocor coming with a bottle and performing the ceremony through which the portion of the soul that has the willpower is actually kind of sucked into this bottle and capped. And now you feel, if you believe in this, that your willpower has been taken away from you.
So it's a combined physiological and psychological
process. But it's very, very rare because in Haiti, you know, when you look at Dawn of the Zombies or the Zombies of Morotau and all these zombie movies that have created such a genre in Western cinema, in this products, films, the zombie is the frightening creature. So you have to escape from a zombie. In Haiti, zombies are not feared. They don't have any willpower. They're totally harmless. They're essentially traumatized people. you know, kind of traumatized and brutalized in many ways. Yeah. But they are very afraid of being zombified themselves. Mm-hmm. So the fear is not of the figure of the zombie, but of the prospect of zombification. But it is something that is very, very, very rare. And it's, as I said, tangential to voodoo practices. And it's, if you look at it as a sort of capital punishment, it is rarely administered. Mm-hmm. And becoming more and more rare as the plants and the pufferfish varieties that are needed to create the potion have become increasingly difficult to find given Haiti's environmental devastation.
Yeah. And you make the point in the book, I thought it was interesting, that zombification stands as a kind of metaphor for slavery and the economic abuse of people.
Yes, it's become an image that is very kind of tantalizing as a metaphor for the condition of slavery and the perfidy of the plantation, so that in the metaphor of the zombie as representative of the Haitian nation under the burden of exploitation and so forth.
Where people's wills are taken away from them.
The notion of restoring the nation. The myth is that if you give salt to a zombie, it will revive. Oh. But the salt stands for the antidote that is given to the person that has been zombified. So it has become a very powerful metaphor in writing about Haiti's condition and the problems of the nation.
Interesting. Moving on from Haiti then to the British West Indies and the other fourth major grouping of Creole religions you discuss, can you talk about Obi or Obey and how it differs from Santeria and Voodoo?
Yes, Obi is a practice that continues to be very prevalent in the British West Indies and at some level in the French islands of Martinique and Guadeloupe, where it is known, similar practices are known as Kambwa. And what is interesting is that the origin of Obia practices, as the origins of Kambwa practices in the French Caribbean, go back to the same religious practices that led to the development of Vodou and Santeria in Cuba and Haiti. The interesting thing has to do with the possibilities of these practices flourishing in their new territory. And because of the circumstances of arrival, the Protestant islands, the British islands, which were Protestant as separate from the French and Spanish islands, where the main colonial religion was Catholicism. In the British West Indies, these practices arrived in societies that were much less tolerant of African practices, and they were repressed in a much more determined and systematic ways, forcing them underground. And the impossibility, for example, of having communal ceremonies over the centuries led to these practices emerging only in their curative aspects. So that Obia is primarily a healing system, except in Jamaica, for example, where there are Maroon communities and some of the ritualistic aspects of West African religions remained. And you have in Jamaica, the development of Obia, as we know it in the rest of the Caribbean, and also Mayo, the Mayo practices, the Mayo dances, did not retain the pantheon of spirits that Haiti and Cuba retain, but did retain the ritualistic dances. And what happened in Jamaica is that you have the healing systems that remain with Obea, and the ritual aspects and the Mayo dance, for example, that enter other aspects, you know, kind of syncretize or creolize with native Christianities in Jamaica. But in the rest of the Caribbean, Obia is a system of healing that allows people to seek protection. You know, the spirits that remained in places where Obia is practiced are more malevolent
spirits.
Yeah,
they're not so friendly.
They're not so friendly. They have awful names like Sukuyan. Sukuyan are like bloodsuckers. Or the Diablesse, this figure of a woman that goes around tempting men into horrid fates, and whose name, Diablesse, also indicates a Diablesse or a female devil. Although that is not the origin of the word. But what is interesting about Obia is that it is a system of healing, but also a system of protection. You know, that we seek protection through Obia practices. They're very good herbalists. They have incredible knowledge of herbs that can be used in medicines, that can be used in baths.
Mm-hmm.
The whole idea of healing baths
mm-hmm.
for both physical and emotional ailments
mm-hmm.
is great on their Ovia. But it also provides all kinds of protections. You can get packets to, for example, put in trees around your house to ward off negative
yeah.
wishes. And
is this the Duppy world that you're protecting yourself against?
Yeah, in many cases, you're protecting yourself from the Duppy world. The
mm.
the Duppy world is the world of the spirits,
mm.
but not the world of the spirits in the same sense as the ancestral spirits.
Yeah.
The Duppy world is interesting in that with practitioners of Ovia, when you die for 9 days,
mm-hmm.
and this is also true of Catholicism, the 9 days
mm-hmm.
of prayers and to assure that the soul goes on its way where it's supposed to go peacefully.
Mm-hmm.
But you have 9 days after the person dies where the soul remains among the living.
Mm-hmm.
And on those 9 days, the soul should be aided through prayer, through gatherings, into resolving whatever issues it has left to resolve
mm-hmm.
before it goes on its way. Souls that get trapped, whose passage into the other world of the spirits
mm-hmm.
is not propitiated well,
mm-hmm.
may remain in this state, in this kind of zone of dopis with unresolved
mm-hmm.
spirits. It's not a place where very positive things may
yeah.
come from. So so you can seek protection from the world of the vengeful duppies in yeah. that in that way.
Yeah, you had an interesting story about a vengeful duppy in a case that
oh,
we're asked
yes,
to testify.
This is a legal case I worked with in Peel County in Ontario. It's in the suburban areas of Toronto. And there have been a series of bank robberies, small
mm-hmm.
suburban banks, 8 or 9 in total. The police had no real information as to who the bank robbers
mm-hmm.
were. They were clearly Jamaicans
mm-hmm.
from their accent
yeah.
and other attributes. People assumed that they were Jamaicans, but they came in with masks.
Mm-hmm.
There was no physical evidence, no fingerprints, nothing. But in the last robbery they did, they killed the young woman who was the manager of the bank. And a couple of days later, an Obia man came to the police station to say that he thought he knew who the men were,
mm-hmm.
that they were clients of his, sort of patients,
mm-hmm.
if you think of him as having a medical function. They were clients that had repeatedly come to him to seek protection. I had actually spoken of committing bank robberies and seeking the protection of the spirit so that
mm-hmm.
they would not be caught.
Mm-hmm.
And for this Obia man, as long as they were dealing with bank robberies, he didn't feel the obligation to come to the
uh-huh.
police. But the murder had crossed the line
mm-hmm.
as to what he thought in his own conscience was permissible.
Mm-hmm.
So he was willing to have his consultation room wired for video and sound
mm-hmm.
in expectation of the young men coming back.
Mm-hmm.
And what indeed happened is that they did come back, and the tapes, which I looked at in preparation for an opinion
mm-hmm.
about the legal case, they came in and the Obia man actually solicited from him a very detailed confession
mm-hmm.
of what had happened. And the interesting thing about the case is that what they wanted on their last visit before
mm-hmm.
their arrest was protection from the duppy of the woman they had
mm-hmm.
killed. The notion that she was not a Jamaican, that the notion that they had no idea whether the 9 nights ceremony would be held for her
mm-hmm.
so that her spirit would depart in peace, meant that the spirit of this woman, her duppy, would be...
come after them.
Yeah. Well, actually would do everything in its power
mm-hmm.
to influence things so that they will be actually caught.
Mm-hmm.
Which indeed they did.
Well, she seems to have been successful.
She
yeah.
seems to have been very
yeah.
successful in this. But what they wanted in their last visit, very specifically,
mm-hmm.
was protection, some sort of packet,
mm-hmm.
some sort of combination of drugs, an amulet of sorts,
mm-hmm.
to make it possible for them to return to Jamaica,
mm-hmm.
because duppies cannot cross the water.
Mm-hmm.
So that if they cross the water back to Jamaica, she would not be able to
mm-hmm.
follow, and then they would be safe.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they weren't,
yeah.
and they are now
That's
in jail.
Interesting.
sort of,
yeah, interesting.
In jail, where we hope they will stay for quite a while.
Yeah.
But as believers in Ovia, I'm sure that they believe that it was this woman's duppy that made the Obiaman go to the police and make it possible for them to be discovered and arrested.
Real sort of spiritual psychological drama.
Yes.
We see it on Law and Order.
Yes, yeah. Right.
The Law and Order doesn't do very well with, well, certainly Santeria.
No, they don't. But occasionally there is something that is... that it's becoming more and more, I think people are understanding more and more the nature of these practices and the
Well,
the
you see
positive.
Botanicals quite often in big cities now,
right.
Shops where they sell herbs to people. So, and anyway, that was my last question I wanted to ask you. Can you talk about how these practices, Santeria, Voodoo, and others, survive among peoples who have migrated out of the Caribbean in the Creole diaspora?
Yeah, it's interesting because you talked about botanicas, and botanicas are everywhere. I mean, if you go to New York City, you will see these botanicas in all kinds of neighborhoods, not necessarily only in Hispanic or migrant neighborhoods, but they're cropping up in various places. And what they are sort of little supermarkets where you can get everything you need to have for the practices of Vodou, Santeria, Obia, etc. And they're multicultural because a botanica will serve practitioners from all kinds of these various religions. Mm-hmm. And what is happening, which is interesting, particularly in the United States, is the development of further creolizations, you know, further syncretisms. So, for example, Puerto Rican Espiritismo and Cuban Santeria have led to the creation of a hybrid form called Santerismo that incorporates elements of both. Because what Espiritismo brings that Santeria did not have was a means of communicating with the dead, of the spirits of the dead.
Espiritismo, we didn't talk about it, but it's a religion born not of these African practices, but of 19th century spiritualism.
And the spiritualism, you know, the idea of sitting at tables and being able to communicate with the spirits of the dead, got creolized in Puerto Rico into a kind of native form of spiritism where there were ceremonies where through dance and ritual, new practices of communicating with the dead emerged. And that's something that Santeria did not have or does not have in Cuba, but it has in New York,
where
new hybrid forms, sometimes through intermarriage, you know, Dominican with knowledge of Vodun because of the large number of Haitians in the Dominican Republic, marries a Puerto Rican, and then new forms of practice emerged and new temples emerged that have creolized further these practices. So what we have in the United States is this incredible terrain, you know, for syncretization of
practices.
Yeah,
it's interesting that these practices morph so nicely, because if you think about traditional Western religions where you do have mixed marriages, they don't really. I mean, people may practice elements of, say, Judaism and Catholicism if you had a mixed marriage, but the religions themselves don't meld at all.
The one thing about African-derived religious practices throughout the Caribbean is their dynamic nature. Yeah. They were formed through a process of constant adaptation, survival, integration of new elements. They flourish through their ability to morph, you know, to take in and dismiss elements as they were needed for survival. And when you have that kind of dynamic element that is built into what these religions are, then no matter where they are, they will absorb and continue with that dynamic nature, which is what defines them.
Great. So I want to thank you, Lisa, for joining us on the Library Cafe over these last 2 weeks.
Thank you. Thanks to you for having me.
It's been really an honor and very, very interesting.
Thank you very much.
We've been talking with Elizabeth Paravicini-Giebert, professor of Caribbean literature and culture at Vassar College, about the book that she has co-authored with Marguerite Fernandez-Olmos, entitled Creole Religions of the Caribbean, An Introduction from Voodoo and Santeria to Obea and Espiritismo, published by New York University Press. And this is our last broadcast for the semester. We'll be back on the Tuesday after Labor Day. You're listening to the Library Cafe on WVKR 91.3 FM, Poughkeepsie.